diminish the power of shame. The embarrassing exposures that Dr. M subjected me to were designed to inure me somewhat to feelings of shame. "Go ahead, put it out there," Dr. W says, speaking of my anxiety. "You may be surprised by how people respond." "Stop caring so much about what other people think," he says, echoing the advice of 100 self-help books. If only it were that easy. The day I'm not nervous is the day I quit. To me, nerves are great. That means you care, and I care about what I do. Tiger Woods, at a press conference before the 2009 WGC Accenture Match Play Championship. "I don't give a shit what you say. If I go out there and miss game winners and people say, 'Kobe choked,' or 'Kobe is 7 for whatever in pressure situations,' well, fuck you. Because I don't play for your fucking approval. I play for my own love and enjoyment of the game. And to win. That's what I play for." Most of the time, when guys feel the pressure, they're worried about what people might say about them. I don't have that fear, and it enables me to forget bad plays and to take shots and play my game. Kobe Bryant, during an interview following Game 3 of the 2012 NBA Western Conference semifinals. "One day in seventh grade, while playing my classmate Paul in a tennis match, I become overwhelmed with anxiety. My stomach is distended. I am burping uncontrollably. Before the match started, the most important thing was that I win. But now that I am in the middle of the match and my stomach hurts and I am afraid of throwing up, the most important thing is that I get off the court as quickly as possible. And the quickest way to do that is to lose. And so I hit balls out. I hit them into the net. I double fault. I lose 6-1, 6-0. And when I shake hands and get off the court, the first thing I feel is relief. My stomach settles. My anxiety relents. And the next thing I feel is self-loathing. Because I have lost to the overweight and oleaginous Paul, who is now strutting around proudly, crowing about how badly he has beaten me. The stakes are low. It is a challenge match for one of the lower ladder positions on the middle school junior varsity, but to me they feel existentially high. I have lost to Paul, who is not a particularly good player. His skills, his quickness, his fitness are manifestly worse than mine, and the result is there on the score sheet and on the ladder hanging on the locker room wall, and radiating from Paul's puffed-out chest for all to see. He has won, so he is superior to me. I have lost. I am, therefore, by definition, a loser. This sort of thing, purposely losing matches to escape intolerable anxiety, happened dozens of times throughout my school sports career. Not every thrown match was as egregious as the one against Paul, whose name, by the way, I have changed here. I often tanked matches against players who would likely have beaten me even if I hadn't suffered an anxious meltdown. But some of them were. My coaches were baffled. How could it be, they wondered, that I could look so skillful in practice and yet so rarely win a significant match? The exception was 10th grade, when I played for the junior varsity squash team and went undefeated, 17-0 or something. What, you might ask, accounts for that? Valium. Squash matches, even squash practices, were making me so miserable that the child psychiatrist I was seeing then, Dr. L, prescribed a small dose of the benzodiazepine. Every day during squash season that year, I took the pill surreptitiously with my peanut butter sandwich at lunch. And I didn't lose a match. I was still unhappy during squash season. My agoraphobia and separation anxiety made me hate traveling to matches, and my competitive anxieties still made me hate playing in them. But the Valium took enough of the physical edge off my nerves that I could focus on trying to play well instead of on trying to get off the court as quickly as possible. I didn't feel compelled to lose matches on purpose anymore. Drugs got me into the zone of performance where anxiety is beneficial. In 1908, two psychologists, Robert M. Yerkes and John Dillingham Dodson, published an article in the Journal of Comparative Neurology and Psychology demonstrating that animals trained to perform a task performed it slightly better if they were made moderately anxious beforehand. This led to what has become known as the Yerkes-Dodson Law, whose principles have been experimentally demonstrated in both animals and humans many times since then. It's kind of a Goldilocks law. Too little anxiety, and you will not perform at your peak, whether on a test or in a squash match. Too much anxiety, and you will not perform well. But with just the right amount of anxiety, enough to elevate your physiological arousal and to focus your attention intensely on the task, but not so much that you are distracted by how nervous you are, you'll be more likely to deliver a peak performance. For me, evidently, getting from the too anxious part of the curve to the optimum performance part required a small dose of Valium. There have been elite athletes for whom this has been the case, too. Rino Bertoia, to name just one, was a young third baseman for the Detroit Tigers who once seemed to have a bright future in the major leagues until, in 1957, he became so overwhelmed by anxiety that, as the Tigers' trainer observed, he couldn't hit and sometimes bobbled fielding plays that should have been easy. The more nervous Bertoia got, the worse he played. The worse he played, the more nervous he got. A classic vicious cycle of ever-increasing anxiety and ever-decreasing performance. Soon, his play had so deteriorated that Tigers management was on the verge of dropping him from the team. Desperate and unhappy, Bertoia resorted to taking Miltown, an early pre-Valium tranquilizer. The transformation was astounding. Bertoia stopped holding himself in, the trainer reported. He's a different man on the bench, talking and joking, and much more relaxed. On the field, meanwhile, he started pounding the ball in tremendous fashion. His batting average rose 100 points. I wish I could say competitive anxiety was merely an adolescent phase, but about 10 years ago, I found myself playing in the finals of a squash tournament against my friend Jay, a personable young physician. It was championship night at the squash club, and a couple of dozen people had turned out to watch. We were two just-better-than-average club players, absolutely nothing of significance, no money, hardly a trophy to speak of, was on the line. In this tournament, matches were best of 5 games. To win a game, you needed 9 points. I jumped out confidently to an early lead in the first game, but I let it slip away. I won the second game. Jay won the third. My back against the wall, I won the fourth, and Jay sagged visibly. I could see that he was tired, more tired than I was. In the fifth and deciding game, I pulled steadily ahead and got to 7-3, 2 points away from victory. Jay looked defeated. Victory was mine. Except it wasn't. The prospect of imminent victory sent anxiety cascading through my body. My mouth went dry. My limbs grew impossibly heavy. Worst of all, my stomach betrayed me. Overwhelmed with nausea and panic, I hit weak shots, desperate shots. Jay, moments earlier disconsolate and resigned to losing, perked up. I'd given him a ray of hope. He gained momentum. My anxiety mounted, and suddenly it was like I was back in 7th grade, playing tennis against Paul. All I want is out. I withered before everyone's eyes. I began, on purpose, to lose. Jay seized his opportunity, Lazarus from the grave, and beat me. Afterward, I tried to be gracious in defeat, but when everyone inevitably commented on how dramatically I had blown my near victory, I attributed my collapse to back trouble. My back did hurt, but it was not why I lost. I had the championship in my clutches, and I let it slip away because I was too anxious to compete. I choked. Just about the worst epithet one can sling at an athlete, worse in some ways than cheater, is choker. To choke is to wilt under pressure, to fail to perform at the moment of greatest importance. A technical definition, as laid out by Cyan Baylock, a University of Chicago cognitive psychologist who specializes in the topic, is suboptimal performance, worse performance than expected, given what a performer is capable of doing and what this performer has done in the past. The etymological stem of anxious, anx, comes from the Latin angere, which means to choke. The Latin word anxius probably referred to the feeling of chest constriction experienced during a panic attack. To choke, in an athletic or any other kind of performance context, implies an absence of fortitude, a weakness of character. The most common explanation for choking in a sporting event is, in the shorthand of the sports reporter, nerves. Choking, in other words, is produced by anxiety. And in the sporting arena, as well as on the field of battle or in the workplace, anxiety is ipso facto a sign of weakness. Since my collapse in the club finals that year, I have learned the beneficial effects of pre-match meditation and have gotten better at titrating my dosages of prophylactic anti-anxiety medication. My wife has also borne us 2 children, which should have put into perspective the existential insignificance of a recreational sporting event. And yet the problem persists. Not long ago, I found myself in the semifinals of another squash tournament. "Why do you play in these tournaments if they make you so miserable?" Dr. W. had asked me several years earlier. "If you can't learn to enjoy them, stop torturing yourself by playing in them." And so I had stopped for a while. And when I started again, I did so with a conscious lack of emotional investment. "I'm just doing it for the exercise," I tell myself. "I can enjoy the competition without making myself anxious and miserable about the outcome." And through the first rounds of this tournament, I do. Sure, there are tense moments. At times I feel pressure, which fatigues me and diminishes the quality of my play. But that's normal. The vicissitudes of competition. It doesn't debilitate me. And I keep winning. So when I step out onto the court for the semifinals, I tell myself, I still do not care. Only 5 people are watching. I lose a close first game. But it's fun. No big deal. I don't care. My opponent is good. I should lose this match. No expectations, no pressure. But then I win the next game. Wait a minute, I think. I'm in this match. I could win it. The moment my competitive impulse surges, the familiar heaviness descends and my stomach inflates with air. "Come on, Scott," I tell myself. "Have fun. Who cares who wins?" I try to relax, but my breathing is getting heavier. I'm sweating more profusely. And as word spreads that the match is a close one, more people begin gathering behind the court to watch. I try to slow everything down, my breathing, the pace of my play. As my anxiety rises, the quality of my game deteriorates. But I am still, for the moment anyway, focusing on trying to play well, on trying to win. To my surprise, my slowing the pace down strategy works. I come from behind to win the 3rd game. 1 more game and I will be in the championship. At which point I find I am so enervated by my anxiety that I can no longer play. My opponent wins the next game quickly, evening the match at 2-2. Whoever wins the next game will be into the finals. I use the allotted 2-minute break between games to retreat to the men's room to try to collect myself. I am pale and shaking, and, most terrifying to me, nauseated. As I walk back out on the court, the referee asks if I am okay. I clearly do not look well. I mumble that I am. The 5th game begins, and I no longer care at all about winning, As in my match against Paul 30 years earlier, I care only about getting off the court without vomiting. Once again, I start trying to lose as quickly as possible. I stop running for the ball. I shank balls on purpose. My opponent is puzzled. After I fail to run for an easy drop shot, he turns and asks me if I'm okay. Mortified, I nod that I am. But I am not okay. I am terrified that I will not be able to lose enough points quickly enough to get off the court before retching and humiliating myself. In 7th grade, at least, I had been able to stay on the court until the end of the match with Paul. This time, with so many eyes upon me and my gorge rising, I cannot do even that. 2 points later, with the match many points from conclusion, I raise my hand in defeat. "I concede," I say to my opponent. "I'm sick." And I scurry off the court in defeat. I have not just lost. I have given up. Folded like a cheap lawn chair, I feel mortified and pathetic. Friends in the audience murmur words of consolation in my direction. "We could tell you weren't feeling well," they say. "Something wasn't right." I shake them off. "Bad fish for lunch," I mumble, and retreat to the locker room. As ever, once I'm out of the competitive moment and out of public view, my anxiety recedes. But I have lost to another opponent I might well have beaten. In truth, I don't really care about the losing. What bothers me is that, yet again, my anxiety has defeated me, reduced me to a helpless mass of quivering jelly, and exposed me to what feels like minor public embarrassment. I know. The reality is that no one cares, which somehow just makes this all the more pathetic. Never in my career have I experienced anything like what happened. I was totally out of control, and I couldn't understand it. Greg Norman, to Golf Magazine on blowing a large lead at the 1996 Masters. The list of elite athletes who have choked spectacularly or who have developed bizarre and crippling performance anxieties is extensive. Greg Norman, the Australian golfer, came unglued at the 1996 Masters, nervously frittering away a seemingly insurmountable lead over the final few holes. He ended up sobbing in the arms of the man who beat him, Nick Faldo. Jana Novotná, the Czech tennis star, was 5 points away from winning Wimbledon in 1993 when she disintegrated under pressure and blew a huge lead over Steffi Graf. She ended up sobbing in the arms of the Duchess of Kent. On November 25, 1980, Roberto Duran, then the reigning world welterweight boxing champion, squared off against Sugar Ray Leonard in one of the most famous bouts ever. With 16 seconds left in the 8th round and millions of dollars on the line, Duran turned to the referee, raised his hands in surrender, and pleaded, "No mas, no mas, no more, no more. No more box." He would later say his stomach hurt. Until that moment, Duran was perceived to be invincible, the epitome of Latino machismo. Since then, he has lived in infamy, considered one of the greatest quitters and cowards in sports history. These are all classic chokes, mental and physical collapses in isolated moments of high anxiety. More puzzling are those professional athletes who, in an excruciatingly public manifestation of performance anxiety, go into a kind of chronic choke. In the mid-1990s, Nick Anderson was a guard for the Orlando Magic. He entered the 1995 NBA Finals as a solid free-throw shooter, having made about 70% of his foul shots throughout his career. But in the first game of the championship series against the Houston Rockets that year, Anderson had 4 consecutive opportunities to secure a victory for Orlando with a foul shot in the final seconds of regulation time. All he had to do was hit 1 shot. He missed all 4. The Magic went on to lose that game in overtime, and then to lose the series in a 4-game sweep. After that, Anderson's free throw percentage plummeted. For the remainder of his career, he was a disaster at the foul line. This caused him to play less aggressively on offense because he was afraid he'd get fouled and have to shoot free throws. The missed championship free throws, Anderson recalled later, were like a song that got in my head, playing over and over and over. He was driven to early retirement. In 1999, Chuck Knobloch lost the ability to throw a baseball from second to first base. This would not have been a problem had he not happened to be, at the time, the starting second baseman for the New York Yankees. Knobloch had no physical injury that would have impeded him. He could throw to first just fine during practice. During games, however, with 40,000 fans watching him in the stadium and millions more watching him on television, he repeatedly overthrew the base, launching the ball into the stands. 2 decades earlier, just a year removed from being named the National League's Rookie of the Year, Steve Sachs, the second baseman for the Los Angeles Dodgers, developed the same affliction as Knobloch. He had no trouble in practice, though, even successfully throwing blindfolded in an effort to break the habit. Most infamously, there is Steve Blass, an all-star pitcher for the Pittsburgh Pirates who, in June 1973, following a stretch when he was perhaps the best pitcher in baseball, was suddenly unable to throw the ball through the strike zone. In practice, he could throw as well as ever. But during games, he couldn't control where the ball was going. After psychotherapy, meditation, hypnotism, and all manner of cockeyed home remedies, including wearing looser underwear, failed to cure him, he retired. Odder still are the examples of Mike Ivey and Mackie Sasser, catchers for the San Diego Padres and New York Mets, respectively. Both became so phobic about throwing the ball back to the pitcher, the sort of thing little leaguers do without trouble, that they ended up having to leave their positions. The sports psychiatrist Alan Lanz half-jokingly coined the term disreturnophobia to describe this affliction. The explicit monitoring theory of choking, derived from recent findings in cognitive psychology and neuroscience, holds that performance falters when athletes concentrate too much attention on it. Thinking too much about what you are doing actually impairs performance. This would seem to run counter to all the standard bromides about how the quality of your performance is tied to the intensity of your focus. But what seems to matter is the type of focus you have. Cyan Baylock, who studies the psychology of choking at her lab at the University of Chicago, says that actively worrying about screwing up makes you more likely to screw up. To achieve optimal performance, what some psychologists call flow, parts of your brain should be on automatic pilot, not actively thinking about or explicitly monitoring what you are doing. By this logic, the reason Ivy's and Sasser's disreturnophobia became so severe was that they were thinking too much about what should have been the mindless mechanics of throwing the ball back to the pitcher. Am I gripping the ball right? Am I following through in the right arm position? Do I look funny? Am I going to screw this up again? What's wrong with me? Baylock has found that she can dramatically improve athletes' performance, at least in experimental situations, by getting them to focus on something other than the mechanics of their stroke or swing, having them recite a poem or sing a song in their head, distracting their conscious attention from the physical task, can rapidly improve performance. But anxious people generally can't stop thinking about everything all the time in all the wrong ways. What if this? What if that? Am I doing this right? Do I look stupid? What if I make a fool of myself? What if I throw it into the stands again? Am I blushing visibly? Can people see me trembling? Can they hear my voice quavering? Am I going to lose my job or get demoted to the minors? When you look at brain scans of athletes pre- or mid-choke, says the sports psychologist Bradley Hatfield, you see a neural traffic jam of worry and self-monitoring. Brain scans of non-chokers, on the other hand, the Tom Bradys and Peyton Mannings of the world, who exude grace under pressure, reveal neural activity that is efficient and streamlined, using only those parts of the brain relevant to efficient performance. In a sense, the anxiety exhibited by all these choking athletes is a version of the blushing problem. Their fear of embarrassing themselves in public leads them to embarrass themselves in public. Their anxiety drives them to do the very thing they most fear. The more self-conscious you are, the more susceptible to shame, the worse you will perform. If you are a man, you will not permit your self-respect to admit an anxiety neurosis or to show fear. Signs posted on Allied gun sites in Malta during World War II. In 1830, Colonel R. Taylor, the British consul in Baghdad, was exploring an archaeological excavation on the site of an ancient Assyrian palace when he came across a six-sided clay prism covered with cuneiform. The Taylor prism, which today is housed in the British Museum, tells of the military campaigns of King Sennacherib, who ruled Assyria in the 8th century BC. The prism has been of great value to historians and theologians because of the contemporaneous accounts it provides of events described in the Old Testament. To me, however, the most interesting passage on the prism describes Assyria's battle with two young kings of Elam, southwestern Iran on a modern map. To save their lives, they trampled over the bodies of their soldiers and fled, the prism reads, recounting what happened when Sennacherib's army overwhelmed them. Like young captured birds, they lost their courage. With their urine, they defiled their chariots and let fall their excrements. Here, in one of the earliest written records ever discovered, is the damning judgment cast on the weak stomach and moral character of the anxious warrior. Many of the sports tropes about heroism, courage, and grace under pressure are also applied to war. But the stakes attending a sporting performance pale beside those attending performance in war, where the difference between success and failure is often the difference between life and death. Societies grant the highest approbation to soldiers and athletes who display grace under pressure and harshly disparage those who falter under it. The anxious are inconstant and weak. The brave are solid and strong. Cowards are governed by their fears. Heroes are unperturbed by them. In his Histories, Herodotus tells of Aristodemus, an elite Spartan warrior whose heart failed him at the Battle of Thermopylae in 480 BC. He remained in the rear guard and did not join the fight. Thenceforth, Aristodemus became known as the Trembler, and he found himself in such disgrace that he hanged himself. Militaries have always gone to considerable length to inure their soldiers to anxiety. The Vikings used stimulants made from deer urine to provide chemical resistance to fear. British military commanders historically girded their soldiers with rum. The Russian army used vodka and also valerian, a mild tranquilizer. The Pentagon has been researching pharmacological means of shutting down the fight-or-flight response, with an eye toward eradicating battlefield fear. Researchers at Johns Hopkins University recently designed a system that would allow commanders to monitor their soldiers' stress levels in real time by measuring the hormone hydrocortisone, the idea being that if a soldier's stress hormones exceed a certain level, he should be removed from battle. Militaries denigrate fearful behavior for good reason. Anxiety can be devastating to the soldier and to the army he fights in. The Anglo-Saxon Chronicle recounts the battle between England and Denmark that took place in 1003, in which Alfric, the English commander, became so anxious that he began to vomit and could no longer command his men, who ended up being slaughtered by the Danes. Anxiety can spread by contagion, so armies seek aggressively to contain it. During the Civil War, the Union Army tattooed or branded soldiers found guilty of cowardice. During World War I, Any British soldier who developed neurosis as a result of war trauma was declared to be, at best, a constitutionally inferior human being, at worst, a malingerer and a coward. Medical writers of the time described anxious soldiers as moral invalids. Some progressive doctors, including W.H.R. Rivers, who treated the poet Siegfried Sassoon, among others, argued that combat neurosis was a medical condition that could affect even soldiers of stern moral stuff. But such doctors were in the minority. A 1914 article in The American Review of Reviews argued that panic may be checked by officers firing on their own men. Until the Second World War, the British Army punished deserters with death. The Second World War was the first conflict in which psychiatrists played a significant role, both as screeners of soldiers before combat and as healers of their psychic wounds afterward. More than 1 million U.S. soldiers were admitted to hospitals for psychiatric treatment of battle fatigue. But some senior officers fretted about what this more humane treatment of soldiers meant for combat effectiveness. George Marshall, the U.S. Army general who later became Secretary of State, lamented that soldiers who on the front lines would be considered cowards and malingerers were considered by psychiatrists to be patients. The hyper-considerate professional attitude of the psychiatrist, Marshall complained, would lead to an army of cosseted cowards. British generals stated in reputable medical journals that men who panicked during combat should be sterilized, because only such a measure would prevent men from showing fear and passing on to another generation their mental weakness. High-ranking officers on both sides of the Atlantic argued that soldiers diagnosed with war neurosis should not be allowed to poison the gene pool with their cowardice. "It is now time that our country stopped being soft," one British colonel declared, "and abandoned its program of mollycoddling no-goods." For his part, General George Patton of the U.S. Army denied there was such a thing as war neurosis. He preferred the term combat exhaustion, and said it was a mere problem of the will. In order to prevent combat exhaustion from spreading, Patton proposed to the commanding general, Dwight Eisenhower, that it be punishable by death. Eisenhower declined to implement the suggestion. Modern armies still struggle with what to do about soldiers undone by their combat-shattered nerves. During the Iraq War, The New York Times reported on an American soldier who had been dishonorably discharged for cowardice. The soldier contested his discharge, arguing it should have been an honorable one. "He was not a coward," he said, "but rather a medical patient suffering from a psychiatric illness. The stress of war had given him panic disorder, which caused him debilitating anxiety attacks. He was sick," his lawyers argued, "not cowardly." The military, in this instance, initially refused to recognize the distinction, though Army officials later dropped the cowardice charges, reducing them to the lesser offense of dereliction of duty. Throughout history, there have always been anxious soldiers, men whose nerve failed them and whose bodies betrayed them in crucial moments. After his first experience with combat in 1862, William Henry, a young Union soldier of the 68th Pennsylvania Volunteers, suffered horrible stomach pains and diarrhea. Deemed by his doctors to be in otherwise good physical health, Henry was the first person to be formally diagnosed with soldier's heart, a syndrome brought on by the stress of combat. This diagnosis had been applied informally since the French Revolution to men who broke down during combat. But it was only in 1871 when a physician named Jacob Mendes da Costa wrote up a case study on Henry for the American Journal of the Medical Sciences, that the condition was formally inscribed in the scientific literature as soldier's heart or irritable heart or da Costa syndrome. Historians of psychiatry often identify this article as the first in the medical literature to describe the conditions we would today call panic disorder and post-traumatic stress disorder. studies of self-soiling rates among U.S. soldiers during World War II consistently found that 5 to 6% of combatants lost control of their bowels, with rates in some combat divisions exceeding 20%. Before landing on Iwo Jima in June 1945, American troops suffered rampant diarrhea. Some soldiers used this as an excuse to avoid combat. A survey of one U.S. combat division in France in 1944 revealed that more than half of the soldiers broke out in cold sweats, felt faint, or lost control of their bowels during battle. Another survey of World War II infantrymen found that only 7% said they never felt fear, whereas 75% said their hands trembled, 85% said they got sweaty palms, 12% said they lost bowel control, and 25% said they lost bladder control. Upon hearing that a quarter of survey respondents admitted to losing control of their bladders during battle, one Army colonel said, "Hell, all that proves is that 3 out of 4 are damned liars." Recent findings issued by the Pentagon revealed that a high number of soldiers deployed in Iraq vomited from anxiety before going out on patrol in combat areas. William Manchester, who would go on to become an eminent American historian, fought at Okinawa during the Second World War. "I could feel a twitching in my jaw, coming and going like a winky light signaling some disorder," he wrote, recalling his first experience of direct combat in which he approached a Japanese sniper hiding out in a shack. "Various valves were opening and closing in my stomach. My mouth was dry, my legs quaking, and my eyes out of focus." Manchester shot and killed the sniper, and then vomited and urinated on himself. "Is this what they mean by conspicuous gallantry?" he wondered. I would argue that Manchester's anxious physiological reaction had an almost moral quality to it, a sensitivity to the existential gravity of the situation. Anxiety, as observers since Augustine have noted, can be usefully allied to morality. People who have no physiological reaction in these situations are the proverbial cold-blooded killers. As the writer Christopher Hitchens, no one's idea of a coward, once put it, "Now those who fail to register emotion under pressure are often apparently good officer material." But that very stoicism can also conceal, as with officers who don't suffer from battle fatigue or post-traumatic stress, a psychopathic calm that sends the whole platoon into a ditch full of barbed wire and sheds no tears. Nevertheless, there is a culturally accepted connection stretching back to ancient times between courage and manliness, as well as an approbative moral quality assigned to the ability to control one's bodily functions when in extremis. Legend has it that when Napoleon needed a man with iron nerve for a dangerous mission, he ordered several volunteers before a fake firing squad and chose the one who showed no tendency to move his bowels when fired upon with blanks. My colleague Jeff, a journalist who has reported from war zones all over the world and has been kidnapped by terrorist organizations, says that neophyte war correspondents always wonder about what will happen the first time they find themselves pinned down by gunfire. "Until you've been under fire," he says, "the question you ask yourself is, will I shit my pants? Some do, some don't. I didn't, and I knew from then on I would be fine. But until it happens, you just don't know." Happily, I've never been fired upon, but I suspect I know into which category I would fall. A coward changes color all the time and cannot sit still for nervousness, but squats down, first on one heel, then on the other. His heart thumps in his breast as he thinks of death in all its forms, and one can hear the chattering of his teeth. But the brave man never changes color at all, and is not unduly perturbed from the moment when he takes his seat in ambush with the rest. Homer, The Iliad, circa 8th century BC. Why do some people exhibit grace under fire, while others fall so readily to pieces? Studies show that almost everyone, all but the most resilient and the most sociopathic, has a breaking point, a psychic threshold beyond which he or she can bear no more combat stress without emotional and physical deterioration or collapse. But some people can withstand lots of stress before breaking down and can recover from combat exhaustion quickly. Others break down easily and recover slowly and with difficulty, if they recover at all. There seems to be remarkable consistency across human populations. A fixed percentage of individuals will crack under pressure, and another fixed percentage will remain largely immune to it. Comprehensive studies conducted during World War II found that in the typical combat unit, a fairly constant proportion of men will emotionally collapse early on, usually even before getting to the battlefield. Another relatively fixed proportion, some of them sociopathic, will be able to withstand extraordinary amounts of stress without ill effect, and the majority of men will fall somewhere between these extremes. John Leach, a British psychologist who studies cognition under extreme stress, has observed that, on average, 10 to 20% of people will remain cool and composed in combat situations. These people will be able to collect their thoughts quickly, he writes in Survival Psychology. Their awareness of the situation will be intact, and their judgment and reasoning abilities will not be impaired to any significant extent. At the other extreme, 10 to 15% of people will react with uncontrolled weeping, confusion, screaming, and paralyzing anxiety. But most people, Leach says, up to 80% of them, will in high-stress, lethal conditions become lethargic and confused, waiting for direction. This perhaps helps account for why so many people submit so readily to authoritarianism in periods of extreme stress or disruption. On the other hand, British psychiatrists observed that during World War II, as the Luftwaffe rained bombs on London, civilians with pre-existing neurotic disorders found that their general levels of anxiety actually declined. As one historian has written, "Neurotics turned out to be remarkably calm about being threatened from the skies, probably because they felt reassured to discover that normal people shared their fears during the Blitz." One psychiatrist speculated that neurotics felt reassured by the sight of other people looking as worried as they have felt over the years. When it's acceptable to feel anxious, neurotics feel less anxious. One fascinating study of stress during wartime was conducted by V.A. Krall, a doctor who was held in the concentration camp Theresienstadt during World War II. In 1951, he published an article in the American Journal of Psychiatry, reporting that although 33,000 people died at Theresienstadt and another 87,000 were transferred to other Nazi concentration camps to be killed, no new cases of phobia, neurosis, or pathological anxiety developed there. In fact, Krall, who worked at the camp hospital, noted that while most detainees became depressed, few experienced clinical anxiety. He wrote that those who had before the war suffered from severe and long-lasting psychoneuroses, such as phobias and compulsive obsessive neuroses, found that their ailments had gone into remission. Patients' neuroses either disappeared completely in Theresienstadt or improved to such a degree that patients would work and did not have to seek medical aid. Interestingly, those patients who survived the war relapsed into their old neurotic patterns afterward. It was as though real fear crowded out their neurotic anxiety. When the fear relented, the anxiety crept back. Military psychiatrists have collected a lot of data on what kinds of situations cause soldiers the greatest anxiety. Many studies have shown that the amount of control a soldier feels he has strongly determines how much anxiety he experiences. As Roy Grinker and his colleagues first described in Men Under Stress, the classic study of combat neuroses during World War II, while fighter pilots were terrified of flak shot from the ground, they found fighting with enemy planes to be exhilarating. The relationship between lack of control and anxiety has been demonstrated many times over the years in non-combat situations, too. Researchers have produced ulcers in mice simply by depriving them of control over their environment, and a raft of studies have demonstrated that people in jobs where they don't perceive themselves to have a lot of control are much more susceptible to developing clinical anxiety and depression, as well as stress-related medical conditions like ulcers and diabetes. Combat trauma is a powerful psychic destroyer. Many soldiers break down emotionally during war. Still more break down afterward. Vietnam produced thousands of traumatized soldiers, many of whom ended up homeless and addicted to drugs. Some 58,000 U.S. soldiers died during active combat in Vietnam between 1965 and 1975, but an even greater number have committed suicide since then. Suicide is also rampant among veterans of our recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. According to numbers from the Army Behavioral Health Integrated Data Environment, the suicide rate among active duty soldiers increased 80% between 2004 and 2008. A 2012 study published in Injury Prevention reported that the number of suicides is unprecedented in over 30 years of U.S. Army records. A study in the Journal of the American Medical Association concluded that more than 10% of Afghanistan veterans and nearly 20% of Iraq veterans suffer from anxiety or depression. Other studies have found massive rates of antidepressant and tranquilizer consumption among Iraq veterans. ABC News reports that one in three soldiers is now taking psychiatric medication. The mortality rates for those who break down under combat stress are much higher than for those who don't. A recent study published in the Annals of Epidemiology showed that Army veterans diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder have twice the premature death rate of their unafflicted peers. The rates of post-combat suicide have become so high in recent years that the U.S. military has made providing prophylactic treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder a high priority. In 2012, the suicide rate reached a 10-year high. A staggering 18 current and former servicemen are killing themselves every day in the United States, according to Admiral Mike Mullen, the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Of course, until 1980, when the diagnosis was decreed into existence alongside the other anxiety disorders with the publication of the DSM-3, there was officially no such thing as PTSD. PTSD is the successor to soldier's heart, shell shock, battle fatigue, and war neurosis, among other diagnoses. As with social anxiety disorder, there remains some controversy over whether such a thing as post-traumatic stress disorder really exists in nature, and over whether, if it does, how broadly it should be defined. These debates inevitably get politicized because of the billions of dollars at stake in veterans' medical benefits and drug company revenues, and because of abiding tensions over the distinction between moral cowardice and a medical condition. For its part, the U.S. military today views PTSD as a real and serious problem and is dedicating considerable resources to researching its causes, treatment, and prevention. The Pentagon underwrites many studies of Navy SEALs, generally the toughest, most resilient soldiers in the military, to uncover what combination of genes, neurochemistry, and especially training makes them so mentally formidable. Experiments have consistently found that SEALs think more clearly and make faster and better decisions than other soldiers in chaotic or stressful situations. As important as the nature of the combat stress a soldier experiences is, recent findings in neuroscience and genetics suggest that the nature of the soldier may be more important in contributing to the likelihood of a nervous breakdown. Whether you are more likely to break down under modest combat stress or to remain implacable even under extreme wartime conditions may be largely attributable to the neurochemicals you bring to the battle, and these are partly a product of your genes. Andy Morgan, a psychiatrist at the Yale School of Medicine, has studied the Special Operations Forces trainees at Fort Bragg who undergo the famous SEER, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape program. These aspiring Navy SEALs and Green Berets are exposed to 3 weeks of extreme physical and psychological hardship to determine whether they could withstand the stress of being a prisoner of war. They endure pain, sleep deprivation, isolation, and interrogation, including advanced techniques such as waterboarding. The trainees selected for the program have already made it through a couple of years of training at places such as Fort Bragg's John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School. The physically and psychologically weak get weeded out long before SEER. But even for the elite troops who make it this far, SEER can be astonishingly stressful. In a 2001 paper, Morgan and his collaborators noted that recorded changes in the stress hormone cortisol during SEER were some of the greatest ever documented in humans, greater even than those associated with open-heart surgery. Morgan recently discovered that the Special Forces recruits who performed most effectively during SEER had significantly higher levels, as much as one-third higher, of a brain chemical called neuropeptide Y than the poorer performing recruits did. Discovered in 1982, neuropeptide Y, or NPY as the researchers call it, is the most abundant peptide in the brain, involved in regulating diet and balance, and the stress response. Some individuals with high NPY levels seem completely immune to developing post-traumatic stress disorder. No amount of stress can break them. The correlation between NPY and stress resistance is so strong that Morgan has found he can predict with remarkable accuracy who will graduate from Special Forces training and who will not simply by performing a blood test. Those with high NPY levels will graduate. Those with low levels will not. Somehow, NPY confers psychological resistance and resilience. Researchers are currently investigating whether administering NPY via a nasal spray could help block the development of post-traumatic stress disorder. It's possible that those in the Special Forces who thrive under pressure have learned to be resilient, that their high NPY levels are the product of their training or their upbringing. Resilience is a trait that can be taught. The Pentagon is spending millions trying to figure out how to do that better. But studies suggest that a person's allotment of NPY is relatively fixed from birth, more a function of heredity than of learning. Researchers at the University of Michigan have found correlations not only between which variation of the NPY gene you have and how much of the neurotransmitter you produce, but also between how much NPY you produce and how intensely you react to negative events. People with low levels of NPY showed more hyperreactivity in the negative emotion circuits of the brain, such as the right amygdala, than people with high NPY levels, and were much slower to return to calm brain states after a stressful event. They were also more likely to have had episodes of major depression, and that was independent of anything having to do with their serotonin systems, which is where much of the neuroscience research over the last few decades has been concentrated. Conversely, having ample quantities of NPY seems to prepare you to thrive under stress. Other research has found that soldiers whose bodies are more reactive to stress hormones are more likely to crack under pressure. A 2010 study published in the American Journal of Psychiatry concluded that soldiers with more glucocorticoid receptors in their blood cells were at greater risk for developing PTSD after combat. Studies like this tend to validate the idea that how likely you are to break down under pressure is largely determined by the relative sensitivity of your hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. If you have a hypersensitive HPA axis, you're much more likely to develop PTSD or some other anxiety disorder in the aftermath of a traumatic experience. If you have a low reactive HPA axis, you will be much more resistant, if not largely immune, to developing PTSD. And while we know that lots of things condition the sensitivity of your HPA axis, from how much affection your parents gave you, to your diet, to the nature of the trauma itself, your genes are a major determinant. All of which suggests a strong correlation between your genetically conferred physiology and how likely you are to crack under stress. But if grace under pressure is largely a matter of the quantity of a certain peptide in the brain, or of your inborn level of HPA sensitivity, what kind of grace is that? The hero and the coward both feel the same thing, but the hero uses his fear, projects it onto his opponent, while the coward runs. It's the same thing, fear, but it's what you do with it that matters. Cus D'Amato, boxing manager who trained Floyd Patterson and Mike Tyson. Are those of us with hypersensitive HPA axes, our bodies set to quivering like mice in response to the mildest perturbances, doomed to falter at the moments of greatest importance? Destined like Aristodemus the Trembler and Roberto Duran for shame and humiliation? Fated always to be victims of our twitchy bodies and unruly emotions? Not necessarily, because when you begin to untangle the relationships between anxiety and performance, and between grace and courage, they turn out to be more complicated than they at first seem. Maybe it's possible to be simultaneously anxious and effective, cowardly and strong, terrified and heroic. Bill Russell is a Hall of Fame basketball player who won 11 championships with the Boston Celtics, the most by anyone in any major American sport ever, was selected to the NBA All-Star team 12 times, and was voted the league's most valuable player 5 times. He is generally acknowledged to be the greatest defender and all-around winner of his era, if not of all time. He is the only athlete in history, in any sport, to win a national college championship, an Olympic gold medal, and a professional championship. No one would question Russell's toughness or his championship qualities or his courage. And yet, to my amazement, this is a man who vomited from anxiety before the majority of the games he played in. According to one tabulation, Russell vomited before 1,128 of his games between 1956 and 1969, which would put him nearly in Charles Darwin territory. Russell used to throw up all the time before a game or at halftime, his teammate John Havlicek told the writer George Plimpton in 1968. It's a welcome sound, too, because it means he's keyed up for the game, and around the locker room we grin and say, "Man, we're going to be all right tonight." Like someone with an anxiety disorder, Russell had to contend with nerves that wreaked havoc with his stomach. But a crucial difference between Russell and the typical anxiety patient, aside, of course, from Russell's preternatural athleticism, was that there was a positive correlation between his anxiety and his performance, and therefore between his upset stomach and his performance. Once in 1960, when the Celtics coach noted with concern that Russell hadn't vomited yet, he ordered that the pregame warm-up be suspended until Russell could regurgitate. When Russell stopped throwing up for a stretch at the end of the 1963 season, he suffered through one of the worst slumps of his career. Fortunately, when the playoffs started that year and he saw the crowd gathering before the opening game, he felt his nerves jangling and he resumed his nervous vomiting, and then went out and gave his best performance of the season. For Russell, a nervous stomach correlated with effective, even enhanced performance. Of course, When a nervous stomach impairs performance, the complexion changes dramatically. Consider the difference between Bill Russell and Donovan McNabb, the quarterback for the Philadelphia Eagles during the 2005 Super Bowl. Like Russell, McNabb was an elite athlete. A 6-time Pro Bowler and the holder of almost all the Eagles' passing records, McNabb was one of the most successful college and pro quarterbacks of his generation. Yet despite many playoff victories, McNabb, unlike Russell, never won a championship. And ever since his team lost that 2005 Super Bowl game, he has been dogged by the claims of several teammates, which McNabb denies, that he was vomiting in the huddle and couldn't call plays. The debate over whether McNabb did or did not vomit in the huddle still continues 8 years after the game and has been called one of the great mysteries in the history of sport. The implication is that McNabb, for all his athletic talent, was overwhelmed by the pressure of the occasion and succumbed to nerves, that he lacked the leadership qualities, the toughness, the literal intestinal fortitude to keep his stomach in check and lead the Eagles to victory. McNabb has never been seen the same way since. Augmenting his reputation as a choker, McNabb's stats in crucial playoff games were markedly worse than his stats in ordinary regular season games. Nor is cowardice always necessarily an impediment to greatness. In 1956, Floyd Patterson, at the age of 21, became the youngest world heavyweight boxing champion. Then, in a series of classic bouts with Ingemar Johansson between 1959 and 1961, he became the first boxer in history to regain the title after losing it. The following year, he lost the title for good in a match against Sonny Liston, but he remained an intermittent contender for another decade, fighting against Liston, Jimmy Ellis, and Muhammad Ali. Patterson was tough and fierce and strong for several years by dint of being heavyweight champion, probably among the toughest and fiercest and strongest men in the world. Yet he was also, by his own account, a coward. After his first defeat by Liston, he took to bringing disguises, fake beards and mustaches, hats, to his fights in case he lost his nerve and wanted to slip out of the dressing room before the bout or to hide afterward if he lost. In 1964, the writer Gay Talese, who was profiling Patterson for Esquire, asked him about his penchant for carrying disguises. "You must wonder what makes a man do things like this," Patterson said. "Well, I wonder too. And the answer is, I don't know. But I think that within me, within every human being, there is a certain weakness. It is a weakness that exposes itself more when you're alone. And I have figured out that part of the reason I do the things I do and cannot seem to conquer that one word, myself, is because I am a coward." Of course, Patterson's definition of cowardice might be different from yours or mine. It's hardly conventional. "When did you first think you were a coward?" Talese asked him. "It was after the first Ingemar fight," Patterson said. "It's in defeat that a man reveals himself. In defeat, I can't face people. I haven't the strength to say to people, 'I did my best, I'm sorry,' and whatnot." But it nevertheless suggests that inner anxiety can be coupled with the outer appearance of physical bravery, that weakness is not incompatible with strength. In rare instances, anxiety can even be the source of heroism. During the 1940s, Giuseppe Pardo Roques was the leader of the Jewish community in Pisa, Italy. He was widely respected as a spiritual guide, but he was also impaired by crippling anxiety, in particular by an overwhelming phobia of animals. Hoping to conquer his anxiety, he tried everything: sedatives, tonics, neurophosphates meant to strengthen the nervous system, psychoanalysis with one of Freud's proteges, and, in an endeavor I can relate to, reading everything he could get his hands on, from Hippocrates to Freud, about the theory and science of phobias. Nothing worked. His phobia dominated his life. He was unable to travel, was barely able to leave his house because of the irrational fear that he would be set upon by dogs. When he did muster the courage to walk the streets, he would swing a cane wildly around himself at all times to fend off the animals he feared might attack. After neighbors acquired a pet dog, he contrived a reason to get them evicted because he couldn't bear to have an animal so close by. He spent hours every day completing elaborate rituals meant to assure him there were no animals in his house. Today, he would be diagnosed with OCD. Roques recognized the irrationality of his fear, but was powerless to overcome it. "Its intensity is just as great as its absurdity," he once said. "I am lost. My heart beats fast. My face, no doubt, changes expression. I am no longer myself. The panic increases, and the fear of the fear increases the fear. A crescendo of suffering engulfs me. I believe I will not be able to hold my own. I search for help. I don't know where to find it. I am ashamed to ask for help, and yet I am afraid the fear will make me die. I do die, like a coward, 1,000 deaths. Silvano Arietti, a young man who lived in the community, was fascinated by Roques. How was it, Arietti asked himself, that a man as brilliant and wise as Roques could allow his life to be circumscribed by so irrational a fear? Roques was afraid to travel. He had never left Pisa in all his 60 years, and there were days when his anxiety was so bad that he couldn't even leave his bedroom. But, and here's what was so fascinating to Arietti, Roques showed himself in other ways to be an utterly fearless man, courageously prepared to defend the underprivileged, the underdog, the distressed in any way. His almost constant fear was accompanied by a constantly available courage. He could handle real fears and, in fact, would bravely help others beset by them. But his own phobias, in their fully tragic intensity, he was helpless to do anything about.